to the seventh case, U.S. v. Wilbon, 081365. Mr. McLaughlin.
May it please the court. Daniel McLaughlin on behalf of the appellant, Maurice Wilbon. Your Honors, the government's strongest evidence of Mr. Wilbon's involvement in the First Bank robbery comes from statements he made while in FBI custody. The problem, however, is that these statements were the result of the FBI's impermissibly coercive tactics and that they were therefore both involuntary and inadmissible in the district court. In the 12 days preceding Mr. Wilbon's statements, he met over 10 times with a confidential informant who provided Mr. Wilbon both with money from the FBI for drugs, and access to drugs. And all this was done while the FBI was surveilling these meetings.
You're not raising any kind of entrapment issue, though, right?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Okay.
The FBI knew about Mr. Wilbon's drug use, and at the agent's behest, the confidential informant pitched a plan to Mr. Wilbon to rob a fictitious bank in Wisconsin. And the plan was to go to Wisconsin to case that bank. On the day they were to case that bank, the confidential informant took Mr. Wilbon from Chicago out of the city and headed north out of the city, but they never got to Wisconsin. Instead, the FBI ordered the confidential informant to pull over in a northern suburb and to go to a restaurant. And it's while they were at that restaurant that Mr. Wilbon was then confronted by several FBI agents in the restaurant. It's undisputed that while at the restaurant, Mr. Wilbon expressed a desire to go home. But he never got home. Instead, he was faced with a dilemma, and he had no real choice. He was in an area where he had never been before. He was surrounded by FBI agents. It was in the winter. He was without a coat or money or a way home, and he was on the heels of a 36-hour crack binge that the FBI had knowledge of. And at that point, any choice he made could not be considered voluntary. His will was overborne, and the decision that was made by the FBI to ask Mr. Wilbon to come to the FBI's offices with him.
What happened to the informant at this point? Did he just disappear?
No, Your Honor.
From the restaurant? What happened to him?
Happened to the informant was when he and Mr. Wilbon arrived at the restaurant, an agent, he spoke with an agent on the telephone. The agent told him, when you see me come into the restaurant, head to the restroom, and I'll meet you in the restroom, take off the surveillance equipment that he had on his body. And then the plan was that the other agents who were there, two of them would confront Mr. Wilbon while the informant sat nearby with another agent, so that Mr. Wilbon would be aware that the informant was cooperating against him. In a sense, they wanted to demonstrate to Mr. Wilbon that, look, you know, we've got you, and this guy's working with us.
I see.
So the key to this claim, Your Honors, is that while Mr. Wilbon is in the parking lot of this restaurant, he's in a position where he cannot make a free choice. He has no real choice in this situation. He has to accompany the FBI back to its offices. And at that point, when his will is overborne, there is a violation of his constitutional rights, and all that follows, including his incriminating statements, while in the custody of the FBI, should not have been admitted into evidence in the district court. Turning to the legal standards for coercion, and that's the way that the court has analyzed these claims in the past, under Colorado versus Connolly, to show coercion, you do have to show improper tactics or what the court calls coercive tactics by law enforcement. In this case, the scope that the district court viewed, the lens through which the district court viewed this case was too narrow. They looked only at whether what happened at the FBI's offices was coercive, when in reality, the 2 weeks preceding the date of the incriminating statements showed coercive actions by the FBI continuously up to and including when the statements were made. And if I may, I'll sort of walk through some of the facts of that I think are pertinent. Mr. Wilbon was in state custody on an unrelated matter, and while in state custody, the FBI was investigating him in connection with the bank robbery that he was convicted for below. They had a confidential informant moved to him, to his general area, in fact, his specific area. He was essentially a bunkmate in the state prison. He was put there specifically to get information, to elicit information from Mr. Wilbon about this robbery. He didn't learn anything specifically about the robbery for which Mr. Wilbon was convicted, but what he did learn is that Mr. Wilbon was a crack addict and that he'd had problems with substance abuse in the past. When Mr. Wilbon was released from custody, the confidential informant was released a short time later, and he was ordered or asked by the FBI, please get in touch with Mr. Wilbon on the outside. Let's continue this investigation. When he did so, he found that Mr. Wilbon was back to his ways of using drugs, and with that opening, he began to provide him money. In a relatively short amount of time, in the 12 days preceding Mr. Wilbon's arrest, he met with him 10 times at least. On each of those 10 occasions, he gave him money. On most of those 10 occasions, he was wired up for surveillance, some for video and audio, some just for audio. But what can be learned from that surveillance is that the confidential informant was referring to Mr. Wilbon as a dope fiend, that Mr. Wilbon's mother was expressing to the confidential informant that Mr. Wilbon had a substance abuse problem and that he shouldn't be given money because that money is being used for drugs, that Mr. Wilbon had been stealing things from his family in order to get drugs. At that point, the FBI has knowledge, and Judge Darrow found below that the FBI knew as early as November 30th of 2006 that Mr. Wilbon did have a drug problem. From there, after continuously giving Mr. Wilbon money, the plan was hatched, and the plan was simply the confidential informant said, I know this bank in Wisconsin. My brother-in-law works there. It would be a good bank to rob. Let's go north. Let's go case the bank, okay? On the morning that they were to go to Wisconsin, the confidential informant met with Mr. Wilbon and drove him to a spot to buy drugs. And on the surveillance tapes, you can hear him say that he's going to see his $5 man, which is language that's used on the street to refer to a drug dealer. What's clear, and Judge Darrow found below that Mr. Wilbon even smoked crack cocaine in the government-issued SUV on the morning that he was eventually arrested. From that point, he's then delivered to Wilmette, where the restaurant is. He's confronted by several agents. There are at least four agents in the restaurant.
Wasn't there some video of the drive from Chicago to Wilmette?
There's both video and audio, Your Honor.
The district judge saw that and listened to the audio.
The district court referred to it in its opinion.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's fine. I think what the district court did, and I realize I'm in my rebuttal time, and I would like to reserve that as well, but I'll finish just very briefly. The contention is that when he's delivered to this place he's never been before, he's in completely unfamiliar environs, he has no money, he has no means of getting home, and at that point he doesn't really have a choice to walk away. He has no free will in that choice. His will has been overborne, and as a result, it's a violation of his constitutional rights, and therefore any evidence that's obtained subsequent to that time should be excluded from evidence, and in fact must be excluded from evidence. And with that, with no further questions, I'd reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Hauser.
May it please the Court. My name is John Hauser, and I represent the United States. The defendant's claim that his statement at the FBI office was involuntary hinges on his claim that he was high and intoxicated by crack cocaine throughout his encounter with the FBI, a claim that was rejected by the district court based in part on the district court's observations of the defendant on the stand compared with the defendant's district court's observations of the defendant on the videotape leading up to the interview with the FBI, a claim that was refuted by all the credible evidence, and a claim which is refuted by the defendant's own actions and his own testimony. First of all, let's be clear about what the defendant argued below at the district court. The defendant in his testimony, in his affidavit, said, and I'm quoting, "I was feeling extremely paranoid and disoriented because I was high on crack cocaine." In his testimony, he said, and I'm quoting again, "I'm like high, paranoid, scared, all at the same time." And we know that cannot be the case, because the undisputed timeline of events was that at 4:24 p.m., the defendant entered the informant's car. It's not disputed that the defendant makes no claim that he used crack after 4:24 p.m. The interview didn't start at the FBI office until 5:55 p.m., and the interview of the defendant, the interview at the corner bakery didn't start until 5:55 p.m., and it's also not disputed that the interview of the defendant didn't begin until after he was read his Miranda warning at the FBI office at 7:55 p.m. Unrefuted research reports show that the high, the euphoric feeling from crack cocaine, doesn't last more than 5 to 30 minutes. So
he could have been scared and paranoid, couldn't he?
Maybe
not high, but scared and paranoid.
He could have been scared and paranoid, but
you don't go back to normal when the high is over if you're this frequent a user, am I right?
Well, I don't believe that there's anything in the record which says what happens after 5 to 30 minutes. What the research shows is that after 5 to 30 minutes, the high is gone from crack cocaine. It's a short-lasting effect, short-term effects. So what the defendant is saying down below can't be right. Now, as to the issue of whether he was paranoid, that fits some of the long-term effects that the research shows, you know, can come from crack cocaine. The long-term effects cited in the reports are bizarre, erratic, and violent behavior, irritability, restlessness, paranoia. We don't see any of that on the tape. The defendant doesn't claim any of that except for feeling paranoid, but he also testifies to the totally contradictory fact that what he's feeling at the time is that nothing matters. And there's some some extensive testimony about how he understands what's happening, but what he's really feeling is that nothing matters. So you can't square that circle. The other reasons that we know that he could not have been, that we should know that he was not intoxicated by crack cocaine. Again, the district court made the observation, compared the defendant's testimony on the stand with his behavior on the videotape. He more than referred to it. He relied on it when he made his findings. The defendant demonstrated mental resistance to the agents through the interview. He refused to sign a written statement. He denied involvement in bank robberies, according to him. He admitted involvement in some robberies and denied involvement in others, according to the agents.
There was no video of the session at the FBI office, right?
That's correct.
How did that compare with the findings of the district judge, testimony about his defendant's demeanor and so forth?
The district court didn't make any findings about the defendant's demeanor during the interview process, but it was undisputed that the defendant had been read his Miranda warnings, so he was fully aware of his constitutional rights. He signed a written waiver waiving those rights when he reached the FBI office. He wasn't handcuffed. He was afforded an opportunity to go to the restroom, have a drink if he wanted it, and the agents testify that he was even allowed to call his mother twice during the interview at the FBI office, that he was allowed to have smoke breaks, that he was interviewed with when the agents were unarmed. They put away their weapons, and he was interviewed in an interview room where the door was open. So that is not coercive conduct. That is not conduct sufficient to overcome the defendant's free will, especially when we consider the fact that he could not have been intoxicated. Based on those reasons and the fact that the district court applied the proper legal test, the totality of the circumstances, the district court properly considered some of the factors I've just mentioned about the Miranda warning. The defendant was 42 years old at the time of his interview, had extensive criminal history, and so experience with the criminal justice system. He had a bachelor's degree. We know his mental state was sound. The district court properly relied on those factors when it determined that the defendant's statement was voluntary. If there's no further questions, then I would ask this court to please affirm the defendant's conviction and uphold the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Police administration.
Thank you, Your Honors. Following up on a question from Judge Ripple, the evidence that was put before the district court below included a report from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and one of the findings in that report was that signs of a crack binge or symptoms or what someone who has binged on crack would feel like afterwards includes paranoia and what they phrase as a loss of touch with reality. Those things are...
Paranoia, as I understand it, is a unrealistic fear that some people are against you.
I believe that can be that is part of the definition of paranoia, Judge Barr.
I think his fear probably was not paranoia at all. It was realistic. Go ahead.
Your Honor, I think a symptom of paranoia or something stemming from paranoia also would be a feeling of helplessness, which Mr. Wilbon certainly testified to in this situation.
Feeling helpless?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that's an indication of paranoia?
I believe it is.
We're doomed.
Also, to follow up on something that the government said in its response, the standard here for whether someone is under the influence is not that he must be completely incoherent. It's that his mental status would be compromised or would be suppressed in some way. And I would submit that when that is the situation, the burden for showing coercion is lower. And I see that my time is up. If
you want to finish your thought, you feel free.
What I was pointing out is that the Seventh Circuit case law says that there's a lesser quantum that must be shown to prove coercion when one's mental state has been compromised. And I would, in this case, that is the exact situation. And for that reason, I would ask that this court reverse the lower court's order permitting the admission of Mr. Wilbon's statements into evidence. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.